done our construction.
Everybody ready here?
We're all paying for it.
All right, we'll open up the House Committee on Human Services on, it says January 27th, how weird. Oh, issued, okay, on February 2nd, 2011, 9 o'clock in the morning, hearing room D. Appreciate you all being here. I think there was some confusion about what time the meeting started, and it will be 9 indefinitely until we have floor sessions that will be earlier, and then we'll have to change back to 8. But we'll try to keep it as at 9 o'clock as long as we can. Most of the people in the audience know that we ask people to turn off their cell phones and blackberries and blueberries and strawberries and how many berries you have. Please turn them off, because even when it's on mute, it does affect our electrical system. And I'm going to remind people that these microphones are very sensitive. So if you're saying something even really nice to your partner next door to you, it will be on there forever. So unless you want that on your record, you might want to not speak to someone. Or if you do, maybe put your hand over. Representative Greenlick, we're so glad you're joining us. We're happy to have you on our committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'm delighted.
Good. And I'm delighted to have all of you here. Okay, we are going to have an informational meeting today. We will be having a public hearing on 2048 a little bit later, but we're going to start out with an informational hearing from the Department of Human Services, and the presenters will be Dr. Bruce Goldberg and Aaron Kelly Seal. So I will open the informational hearing. Welcome, the two of you. It's good to see some familiar, friendly faces.
Good morning. For the record, Bruce Goldberg. I'm the director of the Department of Human Services, and I'm also the director designee of the Oregon Health Authority, and here to provide you with an overview. We're going to this morning really provide a very high level overview of the department itself, and then delve down a little bit deeper with the children and families programs this morning, and Aaron will do that. This has been a transitional year and a half for the Department of Human Services, as legislators who have been here before know, we have been transitioning from a large Department of Human Services, which included the Oregon Health Plan, mental health, and public health, along with children's programs and child welfare, self-sufficiency programs, and seniors programs, into two agencies. And you know, if you look, and I have provided you with a lot of information in a PowerPoint format. And you know, the first issue is that we've been transitioning over the past year and a half. The transition will be complete on July 1, really taking what has been 5 state agencies and creating 2. And we've been doing that in a planned and mindful way. I think, as everybody knows, we've been doing that in a way that doesn't use any additional resources. In fact, we've been decreasing our administrative resources as we've been doing that. And we've been transitioning into 2 agencies. One, which is a health agency that is primarily responsible for all of the state's health care programs. And that's the Oregon Health Authority, and that's our Medicaid programs, our public health, our mental health and addiction programs, as well as our public employee health programs, PEB, OEB, the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, our high-risk pool, our FEOP program. We, as a state, purchase health care for about 850,000 people. And we've done that in a very uncoordinated way through 5 different state agencies in the past. And the goal of the Oregon Health Authority was to create a single state agency responsible for health and health care and health policy. And that's the health authority side. On the DHS side, We have the Children, Adults, and Families programs, which we'll go into in detail, as well as programs serving seniors and people with disability. And at the heart of this transition has been doing this in a way that has been administratively efficient. We are sharing administrative services for both agencies, not creating separate administrative services in each agency. So, for example, whereas we used to have a single human resources office within DHS that served all of the health and human service programs, we're going to continue to have a single human resources office for the two agencies. And they will share that function in a shared service model. The same is true for budget and finance, for information systems, for phone systems. We didn't say, gee, we're going to create new administrative infrastructure for the health authority, and we're going to create new administrative infrastructure for the Department of Human Services. Instead, what we did is very mindfully, over the last year, examine all of our business processes one by one, map them out, determined which ones should be shared, which ones should be split, determined which organization they should be a part of. We've determined how they need to be governed between the two agencies, and we've developed the appropriate kinds of service agreements that really focus on outcomes and deliverables for services between the two agencies. So we've really done two things over the last year and a half. We've transitioned into these two agencies, and at the same time, I believe that we've done it in a model for how we look at government as an enterprise-wide function and look to set up the kinds of shared administrative management that really makes sense at any time, but particularly at a time when we need to continue to run as lean and as efficient and effective as we can. And the last piece of this transition has been, I think, as many of you know, several years ago we began a sweeping effort across the department to transform how we do business, to become more operationally efficient, to lean out our organization as the need for human services has continued to grow. We've really made tremendous efforts at how we can improve our efficiency and effectiveness. We, as you'll see, we've seen dramatic increases in food stamp enrollment in this state. We're responsible for that. We've had 20 to 40% increases in food stamp applications over the last 2 years. We redesigned our work processes around food stamp applications such that we've been able to handle that increased workload without adding additional staff and, at the same time, quite frankly, improving service. It used to take people several weeks to get an Oregon Trail card. Now more people walk out of our offices the same day than ever before with an Oregon Trail card. You know, we've employed the practices that most of our large successful businesses in the world use. We've used lean processes. We've got a lean center. We really look at how we can map out our business processes, look at how we do things, look at where there's work being done that doesn't bring much value. It's really based on a lot of the work that's been done in the manufacturing sector, and really relies on the fact that people who do the work know what's best, know where they're doing things that don't make sense, and really eliminating the kinds of work and processes that don't make sense and add little value. You know, doing things like if it took 15 different work steps to process a travel voucher, you can get that down to 4 or 5. And we've got hundreds of examples of that across the agency. We've actually saved, we met our $100 million milestone this month, where we've saved over $100 million across both of the agencies. Well documented in terms of, you know, we've had 35 completed projects, over 100 that are ongoing, and it's how we've been able to, in essence, continue to operate at a time when we've seen an unprecedented increase in the need for health and human services in this state, and at the same time have seen diminishing resources to pay for that. So at a high level, that's where we've been going in terms of one, transitioning the agency administratively into these two pieces. And with that, what I'd like to then do is just sort of very quickly, at a very high level, go through now transitioning into this Department of Human Services. What is it that we do? We have a clear vision and mission. Our vision is safety, health, and independence for all Oregonians. The mission is to help Oregonians and their communities achieve well-being and independence through opportunities that protect, empower, respect choice, and preserve dignity. We've got a number of goals, and you've got those in your packet. It's about being certain that people can live as independently as possible, being certain that seniors in our community live independently, that people are able to support themselves and their families through stable living wages. That means being able to provide some of the job training and support to move people from being reliant on help to being self-sufficient. That's our goal. Move people to self-sufficiency. We have a huge responsibility, which we take most seriously, around keeping children safe. Not only is it about keeping children safe, but it's about keeping children well connected to their families and their communities and their cultural identities. That we need to honor the choices of our seniors and people with disabilities so they can live their lives as independently as possible. I'm really proud that we've got a long-term care system in this state that's really unparalleled to many in other states, where most people who need long-term care are living in the community. They're not living in nursing homes. Two years ago, we closed our last institution for caring for people with developmental disabilities. That our partners and clients and stakeholders are engaged in in collaborative, meaningful activity. That we provide services that are culturally responsive to the needs of not only the unique cultures and people in our state, but the geographic regions. And I think most importantly, these aren't in order, but the last one is that we're really committed to service excellence as well as to equal access and to equity. We touch an enormous number of people in this state. Over 25% of the population, we touch directly in one way or another. We provide a direct service to more than a million Oregonians. It's astounding. Right now, we have over 700,000 people today. I think it's 720,000. Last I checked, it's now called SNAP, our supplemental nutrition program. I'm an old guy. I still call it food stamps. A lot of people know it as food stamps. But we've got over 720,000 people at this point in time. But over the course of a year, we have over 900,000 people, close to a million people, who rely on SNAP benefits to feed their family. On the human services side, we do the eligibility for all of these programs. We maintain a no-wrong-door function so that individuals who need the health plan, food stamps, help with job training can come through one door and get help. Our Department of Human Services does the eligibility determination for the Medicaid program. We provide TANF benefits to 45,000 people. You can read. We provide child protective services to 11,000 children, 20,000 adults. We assist 19,000 people with developmental disabilities live independently in communities. It's an amazing array, and quite frankly, there's really two points I want to make. One is we've only seen those things increase over the last several years. In our economic downturn, more people have turned to the state for help with food stamps, help with medical care, et cetera. And then the other big piece that I think it's important for everyone to understand is that we don't do this work alone. In fact, we do very, very little of it. Most of the work is done out in the community by local businesses, local providers of services. We have a huge budget, but over 80% of that budget is not spent on state government. It's actually spent on local providers of care. It's spent on nursing. We pay nursing homes, foster parents, grocers for food stamps. We pay daycare workers. We pay home care workers. We pay child care providers. We cut, as an agency, $8 million of checks every day that don't go to our agency staff. It's not our payroll. They go out into communities to support the local infrastructure. We leverage about $5 billion of federal money because most of our health and human services programs are done in partnership with the federal government. For some programs, for every dollar we put in, we get a dollar of federal money. We have other programs, for every dollar we put in, we get $9 of federal money. The food stamp program, we split the administration with the federal government, but the food benefit is paid for by the federal government. So there's a vast array of ways we leverage dollars, but the issue is that we bring in $5 billion of federal money. Most of that is spent in local communities, in private businesses. It helps pay the salaries of child care workers, of people, nurses in nursing homes, people who help keep seniors safe, etc. We provide services really through three organizational arms. I've gone through those quickly. Our Children, Adults, and Families program, which you'll hear more about. Our seniors and people with disabilities, and then we have shared administrative functions that we share both across DHS, and we also share with the health authority. We have some health authority services that are shared with DHS. And you can see our organizational structure, and we'll go into that in more detail. And the last piece I'd leave you with is that we, and I touched on this, that we provide services in every single county. We touch millions of Oregonians. We do that. There are actually about 8,000 employees in DHS. But again, most of our work and most of our budget isn't done by us. It's done by 14,000 private child care workers, 19,000 people who serve seniors, 4,600 foster parents. We don't want 46,000. And in fact, our goal, quite frankly, is to try and reduce the number of foster parents, keep kids safe with their parents. 240 community-based facilities, workers in 140 nursing homes and skilled nursing facilities. It's pretty astounding, both the impact we have on human life, the good that we can do in communities, and the fact that we do this in partnership with a vast array of organizations, which means we've got to do it well. And the last thing I would leave you with, and to turn things over to Aaron, is that you know, people often talk about government being run more efficiently and effectively, and should be run like a business. And quite frankly, I think we need to be better than a business. There are a million people whose lives depend on our effectiveness and our ability to do our work. And so we don't need to be as good as a business. We actually need to be better. We need to be more efficient. We need to be more effective. And that's what we're trying to do, to transform the agency to do that. We provide some really valuable services, and the better that we can do that, the better a state that we're going to be. So let me turn things. Well, let me stop for a moment, see if there's any questions.
Right, and that's turn what I'd like to do, Dr. Goldberg. Thank you so much, Representative Harker. I know you have to leave in about 5 minutes. Do you have any quick questions?
No, not right now. But thanks so much for this overview. It's great. Educational and helpful to get as a newbie to this side of human services. It's very nice for me to have this overview.
Good.
It's going to be a learning time.
Yes, it is, and we're going to be having as much as we can education regarding these issues as we go along.
I do.
If you require more information, you want more presenters, we can dig down and we can get presenters that will give you as much information as you need, because this is a huge issue. It's a huge agency. We have a huge responsibility.
I do have one comment and maybe a question. I really appreciate the comments that you were making about the increased efficiencies that were coming together as you convert five agencies down into two, and the shared administrative services. You referenced reaching a mile point of having saved $100 million. I do need to run to meet with the co-speakers. I apologize for having to do that. I'll be back. But any brief elaboration you could give on that?
You know what? Co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei, Representative Harker. What I will do is send the information to for the whole committee. I mean, we post this on our website. We've got we keep good metrics on where and how all those savings came from, not only the $100 million in financial savings, but also the quality metrics that go along with that, the improvements in services. And it's about 35 completed projects, from anything like redesigning our food stamp work process to how we process travel vouchers to how we collect third-party liabilities on the healthcare side, to we brought the McKinsey Corporation in. They helped us put together a roadmap. We identified a series of places where we could become more efficient, and we've been systematically working our way through that. And so we'll get you the list and all the information.
Great, thanks. I will step out. Just a link or two would suffice to get me started. Might be an efficient way to give me the information.
Good question.
Sure.
Thank you. We'd all like that. Thank you, Representative Harker. Representative
Parrish. Well, I'd like to follow up his question. When you talk about process change with, you know, food stamps, and I don't quite know what you mean by travel vouchers, but can you elaborate on how the process change saved money from my perspective? And, you know, when I change a process in my business, it usually comes with a direct result in net change, be that I don't need a person. So when you did some of this consolidation and some of these process changes, did you actually see a reduction in staff as a result of that? Or where are these? Can you just elaborate a little more on the
savings? Sure. Co-chairs, Tomei and Gilliam, Representative Parrish. Let me take the food stamp place as an example. We dramatically reduced our unit costs for processing a food stamp application. So we processed Over the course of 2 years, we've had a 40% increase in food stamp applications, and we've been able to process those applications without adding staff. So in that case, rather than doing what government used to do, which is applications go up, let's add workforce, we've been able to, in essence, do what you do in your business, which is reduce your unit cost of doing that. We have a variety of places in our organization where we are understaffed, and we have other places where we have been able to become more efficient and transition employees from one part of the agency to another. And we can get you that information. So we've, the issue for us as an agency has been, and I should have included the graphs, has been that the work, particularly on the DHS side, has been increasing at pretty dramatic proportions. And as a result, we've been able to, in essence, hold the line by not adding staff, by continuing to become more efficient and effective.
Can I just follow up that? Yeah. So when you say, so you have not added staff to DHS? Did I just hear you say that?
We've co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei, we've added some staff in some places as we've grown, and in other places we have not.
Do you have a kind of a percentage of growth over the last year or two?
Rather than opine off the top of my head, we can show you the staffing numbers over the.
Thank you.
And the one issue I just point out is that part of the thing that we're going to all have to grapple with over the next year or two is as we create these new structures, it's going to be hard to do Apple. It's going to be hard to look back to compare to 5 years ago, but we'll do our best to sort of map that out for you.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, co-chairs. Just real quick, when you're putting that together for us, could you give us what the department's FTEs are, so, and then what you actually have? So it may say that there's 1,000, but there may only be 800 that are actually there, so we know the exact headcount versus what you have on the books or showing on the books as well.
Sure. Co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei, Representative Widener, happy to we'll get you the sort of information that we've been preparing for the Ways and Means folks, which really looks at positions, FTEs, overtime, and be able to show you some of what we've been able to do.
And follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also, when we're doing that process, one of the things I'd like to know is departments or places where you think you're not providing the services that you should, or probably a department that, because we have to make cuts, and it'd be nice to know where you think those should happen and what should be happening. So, or any regulations or any rules we've put on you that have kind of created a burden for you to where you're not operating as efficiently as you would like to. I'd like to know all of that as well.
Representative Tomei, Gilliam, and Co-Chair Tomei and Gilliam, and Representative Widener, we can get you that. Let me give you an example, because I think it, in many ways, tells the story. What you're getting at is that to become more efficient means a couple of things. It isn't just simply adding or cutting people. It's changing policies and practice. Sometimes it's regulation. When we brought the McKinsey Corporation in, everybody was afraid in the agency because they thought that these corporate downsizers were going to come in and do all sorts of things. And one of the first places they looked at was our child welfare system and how we were staffed. And they benchmarked us against other states and looked at how much face-to-face time our staff spend with clients and all sorts of things. The bottom line is they found out and we'll send you the report, that was an area where we were probably about 30% understaffed, given the work that we were asked to do. Now, the recommendation wasn't to add 30% more staff. The recommendation was there were some work processes that were actually there because of rules and regulations that we should eliminate. And that when you look at both a combination of changing how you do your work, like better scheduling workers out in rural Oregon, the way that FedEx schedules their deliveries, and doing things like looking at some of the administrative processes, the time that workers spend sitting in court waiting for hearings, and looking at some of the workforce issues, that's how I think any business would, in essence, right-size itself. And so we can get you that. And there's a lot of examples throughout the agency where it is that. We've, over the decades, mired ourselves collectively in processes that the agency has done, rules that we've established, processes that have been established by the legislature and statute that you need to systematically go through and take a look at. And I think the child welfare story is a great example, and we'll send you that report and some other examples throughout the agency.
I think that would be helpful for all of us to send that to the administrator, and we'll get that to everybody. And if there's a summary, I know that report is pretty long, as I recall, having looked at it a while ago. If you could also send us a summary,
yeah,
and then also give us access to the report. And please send that all by email so we don't crowd our offices with paper. Any further questions? Representative Greenlick.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Bruce, we're going to be hearing about it here, and we're going to be hearing about it again in the Human Services Subcommittee of Ways and Means. But you pointed out that 80% of your work goes outside of the agency. You have a pretty complicated relationship with the counties and with AAAs and with other things. Can you talk a little bit about when we're talking about restructuring things? There's a possibility to restructure things like your relationship with counties and AAAs and other kind of agencies. It's pretty complicated, I think, isn't it?
Could you, for the rest of the committee, talk about the AAAs?
The AAAs are the Area Agencies on Aging, where many of their services to seniors aren't delivered through the state agency. They're delivered through the local AAAs who have their own constituencies, and I'm hearing from all of them, as I'm sure you all are, from children, from the Commission on Children and Family, from the AAAs, from the on the mental health side with the local providers in the counties. And it's so complicated that it would be very useful if we had a chance to get a better understanding of that network, that 80% that you talk about.
Co-chairs.
You know, this is so confusing. Just say chairs.
Chair.
You don't have to use our names.
Chairs and Representative Greenlick, I'm trying to get used to this.
We are
so
too.
Thanks. I'm trainable. We have a very complicated relationship. We have 36 different counties that we work with, whether it be within primarily on the health authority side with public health services and mental health services, as well as addiction and alcohol treatment services. We have the Area Agencies on Aging. We have three or four, and James Taze is going to come and walk you through that system. There are three or four different administrative structures of how we deliver aging services in different counties. Some counties do it themselves, some we do it, some we have there are DHS staff, but it's run, administered by the county. I believe that we need to relook at the balance between, and this isn't just about counties, it's really about all of the services that we provide. On one hand, the focus on local control and accountability, and two, the administrative burden and the oversight on what are tens of thousands of business contractual relationships, whether it be with individual providers, individual facilities, and with contractors, and with counties. And so I really think, you know, it's an interesting... So when we brought the McKinsey Corporation in, back to that, you know, the interesting issue is if we're going to look for how in our health and human services system we become more efficient, we need to go and look at the Willie Sutton formula. And, you know, Willie Sutton said that, why did he rob banks? Well, he robbed banks because that's where the money is. If we're going to look at how in DHS or in the health authority, where we're going to find the real efficiencies, well, the real efficiencies are in the 85% of the dollars that actually go out to communities. In healthcare, we know we have a healthcare system that spends more money than it should and doesn't get the value that we need. We need to really transform our delivery of services at the local level. We need to look at how we contract for services. We have a lot of work to do in terms of the relationship between, I think, the state and where and how services are delivered on the local level, whether that be the county or the individual providers. It's a big issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Do you have just kind of changing gears here? Do you have any trend information in demographics of who you're serving that, is the lion's share going to children or is it going to seniors? Do you see any changes in those trends that we should be aware of as, you know, I mean, we certainly have a growing aging population. Just kind of what does that look like? I know you probably don't have that off the top, but would love to see information on where you think that need is, you know, projecting this year is going to look like.
Chair, as Representative Parrish, there's really two big issues. One is on the senior side, the aging demographics that are affecting us as a state and as a nation, and we can get you some of that. But we certainly have demographics in this state such that we've got a whole group of us that, well, we're all aging one day at a time, but there's a group of us that, are reaching that 65 to 95 band quicker. And we've got actually a huge growing demographic of over 75 and over 85-year-olds. And those are demographics that, while the absolute numbers may be smaller, you know, in terms of their 10,000 people roughly over 85, it's not like the 700,000 people on food stamps, but it's a very resource-intense group of individuals. So we need to begin to better plan for aging. I'm going to let Aaron talk about things on the self-sufficiency and child welfare piece. I think the big issue there is it's so related to the economy. With senior services, it really isn't tied to our economy in the same way. It's really tied to demographics and aging. In child welfare, in food stamps, in eligibility for programs, in domestic violence, and all these things, it's much more tied to economics. And so that makes it all the more difficult because it's when the need goes up when there's less money. And when the need goes down is when there tends to be the resources. So it's very, very counter-cyclical. And that's what makes some of the issues in terms of managing it very difficult. And see if Aaron has anything to add to that.
Maybe we should hold off until Aaron is able to make the presentation. But do you have anything more? And we will deal with that. Okay, thank you. Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on what Representative Greenlick had hit on with the counties, because it sounds like you're eating up about 15% in administrative costs. And I'd be kind of curious if the McKinsey Group went in and looked how efficiently some of these county HMOs and are functioning as well, because that's where I've heard a lot of complaints is more at the local level and services not being provided and money being sat on there. So I'm just wondering, in the report, did the McKinsey Group go through and look at that, or is that something that we need to address?
Chairs, Representative Widner, two things. One, no, they didn't. They really didn't look outside of state government. So, but recommended that, again, that's where the dollars are. So if you're going to find the sort of savings and efficiencies, we also have to look at our contractors. The other point is just to clarify, when we talk about 82-85% of the money going out, 15% staying in, that 15% is an administrative overhead. You know, a piece of that, of what we do, is direct service in terms of that's not just bureaucrats like me. It's child welfare workers who provide a direct service. We run some facilities for seniors where we have state operated group homes and a variety of what I would call direct service. The administrative piece of what we do is not 15%. So just to clarify some of that.
Okay, thank you. One of the things that we did a couple of years ago in this committee, we visited our local DHS office, and I would really highly recommend that folks do that. It's hard to do because you're down here every day of the week that they're open, but if we're given a day off, that might be a thought to go, because it is fascinating. We learn a lot when we visit our own DHS office.
And if I might, just one last thing. I think that all the people we work with, counties, contractors, health systems, everybody, I mean, they're all doing the same things in terms of they understand that their business models, they need to become more efficient and effective, and they're working at it as well. And I don't mean to in any way imply that people aren't. I think, though, that it's something that we need to really look at collectively and all sort of be leaning in the same direction, because it is, we're all part of a system, and we've got to look throughout it and be able to look at, and I think as a state, we want to do business with the most efficient organizations. And we should do that, and we should contract with folks based on their efficiency and their effectiveness and the outcomes they bring, not because of history or anything like that. And I think those are some of the difficult issues and things that we need to look at.
Thank you. I've not had a chance to look over the governor's budget and what that means for your agency yet, or what his proposals were. But I'm assuming there's going to be a cut of some kind coming. Can you share with us a little bit some insight on, a ratio of what a cut looks like and how that's going to be allocated? So for every, $100, how much of that gets cut down the line versus cut in the agency? Do you have a kind of a roadmap of what that's going to look like?
Chairs and Representative Parrish, since most of the services are delivered externally, that's actually where most of the reductions are. We really, the reductions at a high level, and we're going to get a detailed list out in the next day or two and be certain that you get that. Really come in a couple of different places. One is reductions in the payments that we make to providers, whether that be reductions in what we pay foster parents or other providers of service. And the other is in reductions in the benefits and services we provide clients. Less people in getting daycare services. I'll let Aaron go through some of the additional reductions, but that's where, I mean, we're in a business where we provide services to people and they're provided through different organizations, and when we make budget reductions, it's primarily to either diminishing the service, cutting the benefit or the program, or reducing the payment. And as well as some reductions on the state administrative side, and they're really spread throughout.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. I think we'll be coming up with more questions as we go on. This is a huge agency. It's a huge responsibility on our part to learn about the agency. And so we will be calling back people as questions arise, as you want more information. We really appreciate you taking your morning to join us today, Dr. Goldberg. Thank you.
My job, always come back at a moment's notice.
I know. I appreciate that, too. He is very great about returning phone calls. So if you have any other questions, thank you. Erin.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly-Seal, and I am an assistant director to Dr. Goldberg in DHS. I am the director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division. And as I understand the request from the co-chairs, today I'm here to give you a very high-level overview of essentially the way the work gets done in the Children, Adults, and Families Division. And on over the course of the next two of your meetings, you'll hear in much more detail what the strategic objectives are of our programs, more information about demographics, more information about our partnerships, more information about our performance and our efficiency efforts. So there'll be a deeper dive around our three very major program areas in the Children, Adults, and Families Division coming, and today I'm just going to hit some of the highlights for you. And the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division will follow me the week after next. So just to kind of look out ahead at some opportunity for more discussion. What I think the theme of my presentation this morning, and I'll really try and get through it quickly, just builds off of what Dr. Goldberg had said, which is that we don't do this work in CAF by ourselves. And although we do have a significant infrastructure out in your communities of state employees who are working, we depend heavily on other providers, partners, and community-based organizations in order to achieve our goals. These are the goals specific to the Children, Adults, and Families Division, and what we're really about is about helping people to be able to be self-sufficient, be employed, and help themselves. And we also have primary responsibility for the protection of children who've been abused or neglected. And what that looks like for us is a focus on how we are able to maintain those children, if at all possible, safely in their own homes. And if that's not possible and we have to bring them into state custody, we are one of our major strategic initiatives is around placement of children in foster care with relatives or family. And we'll go into more of that. The work that we do does go beyond just the three program areas, and I just think it's an important point, and Dr. Goldberg made it also. We are the front door. We are the face of DHS in the community, except for with seniors and people with disabilities. And in some cases, we share offices with those divisions also. But people who, in your community who work with DHS are really working primarily with people who work for me in my division, in our local offices. And we take very seriously our responsibility to our communities, and we're, you know, I think our employees see themselves not as members, as much as members of a large state organization as they do as members of each of your individual communities, and they take seriously the responsibilities they have with that. This is just a high-level view of the kinds of work that has happened just in the last year. And always what you'll, one of the things about DHS is that we have a wealth of numeric information. And what I appreciate as legislators is that that can be, depending on the point in time or the person from whom you receive the information, the numbers sometimes can appear to change. So this really is designed to show you just in 1 year what happened in each of our major program areas. And so in 1 year, more than 13,000 children who had been abused or neglected had a foster care experience of some kind. Around 9,000 of them we were able to serve in their own homes. We were able to finalize adoptions for almost 800 children last year. And we also have responsibility for the safety of health of kids, not just in foster care, but of all children in residential settings that are called by statutory definition private child caring agencies, including academic and therapeutic boarding schools. And so we have a licensing unit who licenses and oversees the safety, basic health and safety of many children who are not in foster care. In our program area that we call self-sufficiency, you've already heard about the fact that 1 in 5 Oregonians this last year accessed the SNAP program to support feeding their families. Through our temporary assistance for needy family programs, we did provide cash assistance and employment supports to over 21,000 families, and that represents over 50,000 children. To be eligible for those for that program, you must be living in extreme poverty and have children in your household. And so that's our TANF program.
Could you briefly tell us what extreme poverty would be for a family of four?
It's under 40% of the federal poverty level. If I am remembering this correctly, and I'll have to probably correct myself when I'm back in front of you in a couple days, it's around $800, $900 a month for a family of four. I'll have to go back.
It's around $8,000 a year, I think.
$22,000, 40%. So I'm sure I'll have to correct that number, but just to put in perspective,
that's great. Thank
it's 40% of the federal poverty level. And I do have a chart which I could give you that will show you by household size and by income level what monthly and yearly income levels are at the poverty level. I'd be happy to provide that to the committee, because as you're navigating these different program areas, each of them, either driven by state or federal statute, has different criteria for eligibility around income and its determination. And so some programs, like in the food stamp program, we're dealing with different income levels up to 185% of the federal poverty level. But for our TANF, cash assistance and employment program, we're really talking about the families living in the most extreme of poverty levels with children.
Thank you.
We do also provide child care assistance and subsidies to families and children. And one of the major drivers, Dr. Goldberg mentioned the economy and its impacts. And for us, both for child welfare and self-sufficiency, the issues around drug and alcohol addiction and domestic violence are very significant issues for the individuals that we're serving. And as we think about opportunities to prevent and avoid families going into crisis and needing the help of government, those are some opportunities that we have as a state. We also have the program, an employment program for people with disabilities, our vocational rehabilitation services program. And in that program, there were over 15,000 individuals with disabilities who were helped, and about 1,300 who became employed as a result of that in 1 year. This will just give you a sense of we do have offices across the state. We organize ourselves on the self-sufficiency and child welfare side together by districts. And we have 35 field offices for our vocational rehabilitation services, and some outstationed individuals as well serving that population. This will build on what already you've heard, but it is very true that the number one driver for our program area and the need that we are asked to meet in around our mission is the issue of the economy and jobs. And one of the things that we've been studying in our child welfare program area is actually the influence of the economy and the issue of poverty on child welfare. One of the things that we'll talk about with you Friday that I think is not always commonly understood is that neglect is the form of abuse that we're most often finding and intervening in the state. People tend to have a vision around the child welfare and foster care program that focuses on physical and sexual abuse. Those are certainly really serious and important issues facing kids that we have an obligation to address. But the single biggest issue for child welfare is the issue of neglect. And I think that when we can show you some of our data that we've been looking at around the issue of poverty in the economy, and this is not to say that families who are living in poverty always hurt their children or neglect them, but it is a significant issue when one is living in poverty, the kind of stress that they're under, that we encounter some very significant challenges around supervision, around stress that leads to addiction, that leads to an inability to safely protect and parent your child. So the economy does have an impact, not just on the programs where it's most obvious, like our food assistance programs and our unemployment programs, but also on our child safety programs. As Dr. Goldberg mentioned, every one of our programs is impacted by changes that happen at the federal level because they are federally driven programs. And so we are managing under our goals as a state and our priorities, but also then obliged to the mandates that come to us through our federal partners around what they've said to states is most important to them as they give us resource to partner around those particular programs. It is every 2 years now, every year, as we work to continually improve the work of child welfare, our policy and self-sufficiency and vocational rehabilitation, our policies change and statutes change, and we are constantly in a process of looking at those. And it's important, and this slide makes note that we are just part, when we're serving children and families, it's just part of what probably is impacting that entirety, the entirety of that child and family or person with a disability's life. And so not just changes in policy or practice that we control, but there are many changes that happen, for instance, in the health arena with health reform. Starting on January 1st, 2014, it's anticipated there may be about 150,000 new Oregonians who would be eligible for Medicaid programs. I mentioned we're the front door for that. That's a major driver that is a change in policy on the healthcare side that will impact CAF's ability, the Children, Adults, and Families Division ability to provide service. Just one example. Population issues, quality improvement efforts, the way, simply the ability of our, the individuals we serve to have access to particular services can significantly impact our ability to meet our goals and objectives. For instance, in some of our more rural communities, it's harder for families to access some of the treatment that they need, and that can impact our ability to return their child to them. It can impact our ability to find them a job or help them find a job. So, and we've talked already this morning a lot about our provider and community partner infrastructure and their capacity. When they struggle, because we depend so heavily on many of our community partners to help us meet our goals. This is a high-level overview of our division. You can see our 16 districts and the programs that support them. This will just give you a high-level overview of how the employment and the situation in Oregon and the economy has impacted us for the last 2 years since you left us in 2000. I'm looking at this time frame. It's October 2008. But when you look at that two-year time frame, there's actually been a 51% increase in the number of people who have benefited from the food stamp SNAP program, and when you look at TANF, it's closer to a 40% increase. That's a very significant increase. And I note here the increase in two-parent households who have needed cash assistance. So remembering, again, we're talking about households that are living at under 40% or around 40% of the federal poverty level. And that caseload in the TANF with children and that caseload for those two-parent households in the last 2 years has grown by over 180%.
Wow.
This is a chart.
Thought I was overestimating when I said 40. I was nervous.
I didn't want to I would never correct your boss. But Yeah, I think even we have to continue. That's just an example of how we have to continue to remind ourselves of what, you know, our staff are dealing with every day in our offices and how important the efficiencies are that they're helping us to achieve as we move through this difficult budget time. This will give you overarchingly a vision of what's happening in our programs. We've talked about TANF and SNAP. ERDC is our child care subsidy program. Apologies for the acronyms. I understand they're challenging, but to fit this chart on the page, it wasn't possible to spell everything out. But the fourth line down is our domestic violence services program. We have a program that helps people leaving TANF as they are employed to make that transition. You see the reduction there because of cuts in the budget that have happened throughout the last biennium to that program, so fewer people can be served. In our TANF program, we also help people with disabilities obtain the benefits federally they're qualified for, and again, there are decreases because of our ability staffing-wise to continue serving that population. You can see because of the expansion of OHP Standard and the Healthy Kids Program, our Oregon Health Plan caseload over the last 24 months has gone up 33%, and our folks are processing all of those applications for eligibility. For the Voc Rehab program, they've actually been in what's called an order of selection. Our budget hasn't been able to keep up with the number of people with disabilities who need and could benefit from the employment services in that program, and so we closed the program down and began to prioritize. This is allowable under federal law. We prioritized the clients that we would serve in that program, and you'll hear more about that Friday, but it did result in a caseload decrease overall for them. In child welfare, we've set goals for ourselves to reduce our caseload in foster care. We met those goals between 08 and 09. We lost ground between 09 and 10, and we're analyzing that now. But again, we're looking at the economy and how it's influencing families' ability to keep their own kids safe. But you can see adoption assistance, more children being adopted out of home as our foster care population in home. We have a very strategic effort to try and serve more kids in their own homes, but that effort, as our staffing levels have declined since the freeze, has been compromised a bit. And then we subsidize families who will provide guardianship arrangements for children who had been in foster care, and more and more families are taking advantage of that option, which is a good thing because kids are with their relatives. We've had some of this conversation, and what I did want to remind the committee of as part of that is that last session in 2009, the previous House and Human Services Committee passed House Bill 2123, which requires of the Department of Human Services, including my division and the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division, requires us to come back and provide you with a workload report. And what that report will detail for you is our staffing levels, the policy changes that have impacted those staffing levels, including all of our efforts around efficiencies and how they've offset the need for additional staff. But as Dr. Goldberg mentioned, when we started the conversation about moving away from a caseload model that looked at simple ratios of case per person, the advice that we got from external consultants and others is that no two cases, whether it's an eligibility determination or a child welfare case or even a Voc Rehab case, look alike. It's not fair to assume that a person with a significant cognitive or developmental disability is as easy to help find employment as it is maybe somebody who has a physical disability. Their issues are totally different. And so what we started the process of was time studying how long it actually took our staff to do the federally and statutorily state and federal mandates, what is mandated of them and required of them in the programs, and we created instead a workload model. And the legislature formally adopted that workload model in 2009 for our budget. And so what it does is provide a reflection of how Oregon is supporting financially the number of staff we need to meet all of the current statutory mandates around that program area. So this slide shows you that over, and what we do every biennium through this workload report that we're now going to be providing to you in a couple of weeks or maybe even sooner, is we're going to explain to you how you left us, which this is a highlight of. We were budgeted at 70.5% of the staffing level required for statutory mandates in child welfare and about 75% in self-sufficiency. And then because of the hiring freeze, which we implemented as a result of budget cuts that have happened over the course of this biennium. And that freeze has impacted every level of staff, including it started with administrative staff and senior level managers. We held off. We actually have had that freeze in place since the legislature left in CAF last year for really support staff and senior level managers. And then in June, July of this year, we had to extend the freeze to all direct service staff, so everyone who provides child welfare and self-sufficiency services on the front line and their supervisors. We currently have we have about 380 vacancies. That's about 7.5% of our budgeted positions. And so what that shows you then is what our actual staffing levels are, that people in the field doing child welfare work are at the lowest levels they've ever been. And we're starting to see, well, we really started almost instantly to see the impact of that on our performance measures. So the number of reports of abuse and neglect that we are investigating and that we have timelines, statutory timelines around and policy and practice timelines around which we investigate, the number of overdue assessments in the last 6 months in child welfare has increased by 30%. So those are reports of abuse or neglect that it's our obligation to go out and investigate, which we're not getting to in time. And we take that obviously very seriously.
Don't move beyond this. Finish up what you have to say.
Okay. The issue on the self-sufficiency side is our ability to timely and accurately process people's eligibility. And so it's, you know, those are our two primary objectives, is to make sure people get the benefits that they're eligible for in a timely manner. And as Dr. Goldberg said, we've had some very impressive efforts to streamline the front door. That has come at a cost. We've prioritized the front door as a place where people walking in need to get their benefits, but we have federal and state requirements around ongoing paperwork that has been getting slower and slower and slower. So anytime someone changes their address or their income changes and they let us know that, we need to reevaluate their eligibility, and those things have been slowing down. And our accuracy rates have remarkably stayed pretty high but are slipping. And so the staffing, you know, I think my point overall is that we've gone through a very significant process, and I'm going to tell you more about it, to be sure that we're working effectively and efficiently to transform and reduce waste. We've been prioritizing our work to make sure that the things that matter most are the things that staff know we're asking them to do first. And we've been working on some technology enhancements and improvements so that we can leverage better our systems and our electronic support. We've been very deliberately tracking our measures and our metrics so we know where we're slipping. And the staffing levels are low right now, and our staff are feeling that, as are the people we serve. And it really comes down to that customer service issue. I had recently a phone call from one of your members about a foster parent who was frustrated because they had heard that they had decided they wanted to open up their home to a child in foster care, which is something that's incredible and that, you know, I have so much respect on an individual level, and we have a lot of need for on a global level, and we haven't been able to get to their application in time, and they were frustrated that they hadn't heard back from one of our staff. And, you know, we, of course, gave them another call to say, we're really sorry, we haven't been able to process your application, but we've had to prioritize some other applications over yours right now because of our staffing issues.
I just think this is so important, colleagues. We're asking more and more of this agency and providing them less and less. And these figures come from an outside agency. They don't come from this agency that's saying we need more staff. We know they are understaffed. And we've heard that as the economy goes down and people are applying for more and more services, they're being asked to do more, and we're giving them less staff. If any of you, I did this at the office, the local DHS office, when we first started that same day providing food stamps, SNAP, and it was, people did move through. It was incredible. But in talking to the staff, they were saying how their paperwork was piling up because they were doing what we had asked them to do, which was to give immediate services to people who needed cash assistance or food stamps, and yet the pressure was on the staff themselves because they were behind in their paperwork. So I just want to, when Erin tells us these things, she sort of tells us in a very pleasant voice. But what I'm hearing is a scream that we are asking a lot from this agency. We're asking more of them and providing them less ability to serve. So thank you for stopping there, Erin. Thank you.
We do provide support centrally for all of our field structure, and I just thought it was important because I know as we think about administration, it's almost it's important, I think, to provide definition as to what that looks like. And for us in our division, our customer administratively is our field staff and the providers who help us meet the needs of the clients. That's ultimately our role. So this is just a list of the kinds of work that we do in central office in support of providing good and effective and efficient customer service to our field structure. We've talked about this, and I'm just going to try and speed up because you're going to have to hear from me for the next few days. So we take very seriously both because we are public servants and taxpayers depend on us to spend the resource they invest in us wisely and effectively, but also because out of self-interest, because the demand is great, we feel everyone who works for me is committed to helping people. There's one thing we all have in common. They're there because they want to help other people, and they believe they can do that. And selfishly, if we can eliminate things that don't add value, we can help more people. And so we have been working on, and we have a very specific plan for improvement around all of our program areas. And we have some specific examples. You've heard a lot about the SNAP same day. That's meaning that Oregonians are being seen on average 9 days sooner than they were prior to that initiative having happened. We've been able to find ways to eliminate actual costs for things like postage. We have been working on that ongoing paperwork to try and eliminate the number of steps and things that people need to do so that they can not feel, so that they can timely process and maintain accurate records of where people are in terms of their eligibility. And we've been... We've actually saved the state quite a bit of money around different processes relating to benefits for individuals who are incarcerated. And so there's a lot that we've done and more that we continue to do. We've got a lot of our process improvement in child welfare will roll out as part of our new technology system, and I'll share more about that in a moment, but that's the OR, or Kids for Child Welfare. And we've been looking all the way through support staff and implementation of really, Dr. Goldberg mentioned this, but that lean process, which has been implemented in many non-governmental sectors, but it's a leadership staff empowerment model that allows for problem solving in real time and allows larger issues that are statewide and systemic to have a process for being addressed and become part of the larger transformation continuous improvement effort. Almost every one of our continuous improvement efforts ends up pointing toward technology in our division, because our technology systems that support both child welfare and our self-sufficiency programs are nearly 30 years old. And I said that accurately, 30 years old. And when you think about how quickly the pace of technology is now moving, I mean, your phone is outdated in about... Your BlueBerry is outdated in about 5 months. To know that the staff that are doing this important work, I mean, you know, all of the work is important, meeting people's most basic needs, the health issues and safety issues that people are addressing. It's one of the things you would see if you were able to visit one of our offices is how frustrating the technology is for our staff. It actually works against staff. One example of that, so we've put in place some strategic plans around modernizing those systems. In the self-sufficiency arena, dealing with the eligibility for food stamps, TANF, and the health plan primarily, but other programs as well. You can see the benefits that we've defined around how we want to modernize that system. And it's a necessary modernization if we're going to fully leverage the advancement that's expected under health reform and where we're headed in terms of health information technology. And it will I think, offset our staffing gap once we're able to modernize our technology, and it will improve our customer service greatly. Currently, there are over 17 categories, for example, of eligibility for just Medicaid programs, and our staff actually use calculators to determine people's income and which of those criteria they fall into. In ORCIDS, this is our technology infrastructure for child welfare. We're taking five systems and combining them into one to come into federal compliance. This is going to help us protect kids better. Pure and simple, this is a child safety system in and of itself. Right now, when you pick up, if somebody picked up the phone and reported abuse to us, the only record, just as an example, that would be available to that screener is the record by the name of that child and that family. And there are other records, we don't collect information by the name automatically in our system of the perpetrator of the abuse. And so what will change, for instance, is if that perpetrator that's being called, if the report to us is about a foster parent, the screener will now automatically have information that says this is one of our foster homes, and we need to get out there, not just right away because there's possibly a child victim, but we've got to pull that file and figure out if there's more going on here because this is somebody that we license and monitor and oversee as a foster parent. That has to happen by paper today. When the technology comes to bear, it won't be a paper-driven process. It'll be electronic. It'll be real-time, and it's going to better protect kids.
I hear they're down to one computer.
I
said in the child hotline, and the person, every single call had a time bomb in it. I mean, it was scary as hell just listening to them making decisions. But at that time, the person had not two screens, but two separate computers, and having to work between, I mean, it was just amazing, and they did extraordinary. I understand you're down to at least one computer now, is that? On the desk.
Co-chairs, Representative Greenlick. I'm not sure, I have to double check on the one computer, but we have been working on being able to provide our screeners dual monitors so that they can toggle back and forth and have better access to information. Haven't ever looked at it from the computer perspective, but I will. Every office is different. I mean, some of our offices in our small rural communities have not. It's taken us longer to help them benefit from some of the technology that some of our bigger hotline offices benefit from.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I really recommend our committee folks to spend a day listening to the child abuse hotline as a way of getting an incredible sense of the sort of extraordinarily difficult work they deal with every day. It scared the hell out of me.
I think that's an excellent idea. Maybe what we can do as our caseload goes down or our referrals go down, maybe we can take committee time to visit one of those offices. That's a great idea. Thank you.
These are some examples which we'll go deeper into when we talk about specific programs with respect to just the providers that we rely on to keep children safe, to help us find employment for people, to help support or maintain employment for persons with disabilities. There are many, many community partners that we don't actually support financially who support the goals and efforts that we make as a division. And I want to just recognize them. For example, at the top, our food bank and our hunger nutrition partners, they have helped us immensely around our food stamp participation in the state to be sure that people who are eligible for those benefits have access to them. And as a result, our state actually has been recognized federally for our participation levels and been awarded federal monies, which we then share with our community partners because they've been, it is a true partnership. And we are thankful for that. We work with faith-based organizations. I heard a very heartwarming story a couple of weeks ago, months ago. We have a strategic effort to prevent foster care entry when we can do that. There was a family who was homeless that we were paying for the mother had fled her abusive partner. We were paying for them to stay in a motel. We weren't sure. That's not something, we don't have money for housing in our budget. That wasn't something that was sustainable for us to continue financially to support. The shelters were full. If we were to have not done that, we would have had to remove the children from this mom's custody, which is traumatic for those children, for the mom, for the entire family. We called one of our church partners in the community. The congregation stepped up and provided a home for this mom and her children to stay in and 6 months rent while she got her feet under her. And that wouldn't have happened without the relationship with that faith community, and that mom and those children are now together. And we were able to walk away with a safety plan knowing that that mom had her kids protected.
I don't want to
leave this. Aaron, could you stop there, Mr. Co-Chair?
I'm just like her. I didn't want you to leave a slide, and I didn't want to interrupt you. Are you done with that?
Sure.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
If I may. I've been looking forward to this slide, and I don't think it's necessarily the key or the answer to a very serious situation that you've lined out for us. Thank you for being here, and thank you for this testimony. But this slide encourages me, and I hope it does others. I guess my comment, you can comment on it if you want, is recognizing how difficult it is to vet volunteers and how serious the issues are around, take the example of child abuse. You got to be very careful who you're bringing in, who's been trained, and all that. I understand that. I still think that this state and our communities are so full of people willing to step up exactly the way you described. So I'm not preaching to you. I'm just saying this is encouraging to me, and I hope we can think about this aspect, lest the committee thinks I'm advocating a DHS bake sale and everything will be fine. I really do think there's resources here. I think we have a lot of NGOs that I'm disappointed in who spend more time lobbying in the building because they're so focused on policy, like everybody is in Salem, and they have resources and rank and file volunteers. I don't care if it's faith-based or otherwise. Tonight in Silverton, I'm going to go to a dinner that I try to go to every Wednesday night that just simply bubbled up 2 years ago when people just saw how many families were hungry. I'm a preacher's kid. And we used to do this all the time. I called my dad and said, oh my gosh, I think I went back in time because I'm going to places where there, to this dinner where there's casseroles. I haven't had casseroles since I, this started, you know, 2 years ago, we were feeding 30 families. And here was one of the keys was this, our church anyway, decided that this wasn't going to be a soup line. This was going to be everybody's invited. There's no vetting of your economic level or your difficulty. Tonight, I guarantee you will serve 400 to 500 meals to people of all walks of life, many of whom desperately need this and bring their children, for one good home-cooked, you might say, warm meal. Silverton is not unlike every town in the districts represented up here in this building. So, pardon the speech, this is encouraging to me, and if I can help explore how we can harness this in ways that are safe and appropriate for the restrictions that you have for delivering the services, I want to do that.
Co-Chair Gilliam, I just appreciate that perspective, and I will make one comment, which is, again, back to the theme that we don't do this alone. What I probably haven't said directly enough and should is that the services that I'm responsible for in this division are designed to be temporary. And so we see it as one of our primary obligations to be sure that whatever community resources are available are brought to bear for the children, families, persons with disabilities that we're helping to serve. Because we hope not to be a long-term fixture in a child, family, or person's life. And we want to be sure that when we walk away, the supports that we brought don't walk away with us, and that that person remains connected to community and to community resource. And it's one of the reasons why we have held on as hard as we can to our internal volunteer program It's also one of the reasons why our partnership with the Commission on Children and Families has been really important to us with business, the business community around particular issues that are of interest to them with respect to employment. And I agree. I think it is an area where, as a state, we have a lot of strength, and we need to continue to tap into that on behalf of our clients.
Thank you.
We also need to be mindful in our world that we, they're usually involved in our families' lives are, is more than just one group of people. And in order to most effectively work through whatever issue is going on for that family, and so we not only are committed to collaborating across our provider communities and in communities themselves with non-governmental agencies, but also across systems. And so one of the opportunities and challenges, I think, that's facing us right now with the budget is that I think there are some opportunities for us to think differently about our cross-systems approaches to kids and families in particular. We have many, many people and agencies who are committed, and I think if one of the things I've seen happen, it's not mentioned here, but around our safe and equitable reduction, we've had alignment around a specific series of priorities and a common agenda, and we've actually seen traction with multiple child-serving agencies, including the judicial branch, the Commission on Children and Families, service providers in communities, and even different opportunities with education and the youth authority. And we've got to continue doing business that way. We're committed to monitoring our performance. We're committed to transparency and accountability in our division. Every month for your district, if you were interested in seeing the counties that you represent and how they're performing in terms of our performance, we have online available what we call our dashboard report. You can look at the measures that we are tracking most closely around child safety, around timeliness and accuracy of benefits, and you can see how in your community we're doing. I included an example here about how often our staff are getting out into homes to see kids every 30 days, which is our at least once every 30 days is our goal and our measure. You can see that we've struggled a bit in since really starting in June when that hiring freeze, we've been dipping down below the 80% level, and that we trace directly back to our staffing levels in child welfare. Just people are carrying more cases, have more to do, and it's harder. There are fewer of them to do the work. So you're going to hear more over the coming days about specifics in each of our program areas, and I just really appreciate the opportunity and would make myself available anytime to any of you individually about specific areas of interest you have or additional detail that maybe we aren't providing you that you need.
Thank you so much, Erin. Any questions of Erin before she leaves us? Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Erin, I've been particularly worried about the tsunami of autism that's hitting us, and I wonder if you have any special involvement with autism, how it affects your agency, and if there's anything you're doing to deal with the problem.
Co-chairs, Representative Greenlick. I think what is happening around the autism issue is impacting our agency. When you look at foster care through the perspective of the developmental disabilities system, Mary Lee Fay can correct me, but I believe about 40% of the children that they're serving with developmental disability services are actually children who are in state custody in foster care. And so my understanding is that autism is the major driver of children's access to developmental disability services right now. And as their caseloads are going up, what that will translate to potentially are families who are not able to safely maintain those children in their own homes, which can increase then the cost to us in our foster care program. So then that family and child are being served in two programs. It's one of the reasons why you actually heard from our division when the legislature was considering reductions to family supports for families who are raising children with developmental disabilities, because there is this crossover between us and them. And the cost to serve a child annually in foster care on average is around $26,000 per year. And that's not inclusive of the additional cost to serve a child with a developmental disability. The benefit and support we traditionally provide families to maintain that child in their home is significantly less than that. So it's not only I think what you will see happen is this, as we're getting our arms around with the help of the Autism Commission that's been at work, what it's going to take to provide education services and the different degrees of severity and how those are going to impact and play out over time, our children's opportunities and our families' ability to cope, we are concerned that it will result in families who aren't going to be able to cope and maintain their child in their own home and community, and that's going to cost a lot to that family and child and also to the state.
Thank you. We need to move on because we have a bill coming up, you bet. We learned a lot today. I'm sure a lot of questions will be coming up to you as you think about what we've heard today. Please contact me and let me know if you'd like anything more specific, and we will have further hearings in the future. Thank you both so much for coming and helping us today.
Appreciate I'm sure it. We'll see you again.
I'm sure you will.
I hope
will.
So.
I'm going to close the informational hearing and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2048. Jennifer.
Chairs Tomei and Gilliam, committee members. House Bill 2048 clarifies that the Department of Human Services does not contract with nonprofit legal service organizations or lawyers to represent recipients of SSI, SSDI program assistance and administrative hearings before the Social Security Administration, instead maintaining a list of and referring recipients to these services, requires the recipients to sign an interim assistance reimbursement agreement when applying for SSI benefits, and measure would align the state statute with the current SSA policy.
Okay. Jennifer, I might not have said this to you in the past, but we try not to use acronyms.
Okay.
And so there were a lot in there. So could you sort of go through and tell us what those letters mean?
Okay. The SSI, is the Supplemental Security Income Benefits, and SSA is the Social Security Administration.
And SSDI is?
It's part of the
Security Disability Insurance.
Pardon me?
Social Security Disability Insurance.
Right. Okay. All right. I think everything else is clear. Thank you very much. Okay. And we have two people who signed up to speak, Mickey Cerise and Erica Miller. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. For the record, excuse me, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm Deputy Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services. I work in Children, Adults, and Families, the division, and that was one of the divisions Aaron spoke to earlier today. I'm here primarily to introduce to you Erica Miller. She's one of our program managers, and she is new to our legislative process, and we are always encouraging young folks who would like to become active with the legislative process and to work with you in an ongoing way. And in spite of my comments to her about the legislative process, Erica is very excited about starting this. So it was a gentle caution about the work that we do for the 5 months that we have with the legislature. Very enjoyable. It is 5 months of dedication, though.
Great.
And just to preface a little bit, Children, Adults, and Families as a division will have 8 bills. Most of those bills will come before this committee. This is one of those bills that is being introduced by the department. It's a bill that we refer to as a cleanup bill, and then I'm going to let Erica, who is our program expert, explain a little bit more about that bill to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee. My name is Erica Miller, and I'm the program manager for the State Family Pre-SSI, Pre-SSDI program, and I am happily here today to testify in support of House Bill 2048. Before I do that, if there are no objections, I'd love to give you a brief program description. State Family Pre-SSI, Pre-SSDI program serves TANF-eligible adults who have severe disabilities that meet Social Security disability criteria. The program was implemented in November of 2007 as part of the TANF redesign. Program benefits include a cash grant and also professional level assistance with applications for Social Security benefits and also the pursual of those benefits in the appeals process. When clients are ultimately awarded supplemental security income, the department is able to actually recoup some of the grants from the TANF eligible adult side to reimburse program expenditures, and that comes from the client's SSI lump sum payment. As Mickey mentioned, this is really a technical fix, and the proposed change is actually for a couple of reasons, so I'll highlight two of those reasons for you. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Fine.
The changes in the bill will ensure that the statutes identified accurately reflect the intention of the TANF redesign, which supports the use of, by requiring clients to cooperate with the department in applying for SSI and also in signing the interim assistance reimbursement agreement. In doing that, that allows the department to actually collect that reimbursement once the client is awarded SSI benefits. Secondly, it also will ensure that our statutes are aligned with SSA policy, which supports the use of a single application for SSI benefits. So, in essence, an application for SSI is also an application for SSDI, which was the Social Security Disability Insurance Benefit. It also supports, SSA policy also supports us sharing with the client a list of nonprofit legal services organizations and also attorneys rather than actually contracting with them. As noted in my written testimony, we are not currently contracting with legal services organizations or attorneys. However, we do offer clients a list of attorneys if they so desire. Good news. Our clients have been very successful in their applications for SSI benefits through our program. Since the program's inception in 2007, we've increased our level of approvals fourfold. In 2010, we had 443 clients who were approved for SSI benefits, and the department was able to recoup $1.3 million. I believe you have my written testimony before you. I truly appreciate the opportunity to testify in front of you in person, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Erica. Any questions? Representative Greenlink.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at line 13 through 16, and I just want to make sure this change isn't a clarification. This change is a change in policy, right? Because it says in the current law, you shall contract with, and now it points out you will not contract with.
This is correct.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I've got one, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, and I want to ask you about a couple of those lines, too. But before I do, caution that you received about the legislature is probably well received, but I would also say be careful of people who've testified in this committee before you who give you advice. Are there cost savings in the move that Representative Greenlink was talking about from contracting with versus giving a list?
Yes, Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, pardon me.
My grandmother.
At this point, no one has requested that we actually provide the services that are highlighted in the statute. If someone were to ask the department to, in fact, provide representation, there would be a fiscal cost for that, which we currently are not representing in our fiscal analysis because the department is not currently providing that service. So, in effect, with the change, there is no fiscal impact. If we were to have to implement the statute as it's currently written, there would be a fiscal impact, and that does show on the fiscal impact statement, and it's approximated at $1.5 million per biennium.
I've got enough.
Up to.
I'm going to follow up.
Follow up?
So just to understand this, you haven't been doing that, although you should or could have under the statute. And I'm all for savings, but are we, I'm trying to understand this, are we shifting a cost to folks who can least afford it to contract or to, what do you call it when you hire a lawyer? The end of, no. To contract with a lawyer? Are we asking them to pick up something that we were, or is it not really changing who's paying for the lawyer?
Representative, I'm sorry, Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam. At this time, the Social Security Administration does pay for the representation out of the client's lump sum payment. If we were to pick up that cost, and it is conceivable that the department would add that cost as a general fund expenditure. But currently, if a client has representation, that does come out of their lump sum payment, and that is what is currently occurring.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, no one else has signed up to testify. Is there anyone here who wants to testify? John looks very interested.
Madam Chair, co-chairs, we'd like Bruce Goldberg and try to figure that out. Members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen from the Oregon Law Center. I just wanted to provide a very quick clarification. I was involved in the work group, House Bill 2469, the TANF redesign. The discussion at that time was to make available some of the nonprofit organizations like Oregon Law Center, Legal Aid Services of Oregon, to provide these services and to have that kind of contract in place. As a practical matter, many of our offices really don't do any of that business because private attorneys are available to do that. And as Erica Miller mentioned, there's the opportunity for reimbursement once there's a lump sum payment. And if I might, I just want to add just very quickly that this whole process of helping people get SSI, SSDI benefits is something that was written into the TANF redesign, which has been a very good step, and we still have those people without children, the former general assistance clients that go without this service. So I just thought I would add that on. But we have no objection to the bill.
Thank you. Any further questions? All right. Thank you all very much. Anyone else who wants to speak on this bill? Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2048. And colleagues, I just want to remind you again that we will be meeting from 9 until 11 until the floor sessions are starting earlier. I will ask Jennifer to email folks and remind them of the time change. So anything for the good of the order? You learned a lot today.
Oh, yeah.
If there's any questions, concerns, any more information you'd like, please let me know. Thank you. With that, I will close the House Committee on Human Services. Thank you all.